Hello and welcome to Required Reading, the podcast that revisits the most impactful books from our childhood. I'm your host, Erin Bowles. I am a writer, actor, and comedian. Today is another Erin. Erin Taylor is an American writer and author of Bimbo Land. They write poetry, fiction, screenplays, and previously served as the arts editor of Observer. They live and write in Los Angeles. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. We love an Erin v. Erin moment.
I feel like I don't run into a lot of other Erins, so it's nice. It's refreshing.
No, actually, same. I've really, especially spelled with the E and not like, you know, the A and the more Hebrew format for Erin, I've only run into less than five Erins in my life. Yeah. I think it was a very popular name before our generation. Our parents just grasped the last bit of that name. You know, they were like, let's throw one in there into the world. And we just keep meeting each other occasionally. We're speaking of one name would not work in The Awakening. Like, I did not read a single Erin in this book, which is fine. And I'm curious, like, when you first read The Awakening, before I even get into mine, I'm just curious, because it is such a special book.
Yeah. So our book today is The Awakening by Kate Chopin. This was my first read. I'd never read it before.
Oh my goodness. I'm actually jealous of you that you read it as an adult, which I'll get into for the first time, because I do think that is honestly the better way to read this work.
Yeah.
As an adult, for sure.
Yeah. What's your story with it?
So I read it, just, I guess, for anybody listening who isn't familiar with The Awakening, it is a book that, especially in the South or Midwest in the United States, is like very often given to young people to read in class, right? Like whether it be high school, usually high school, it's very much that type of work. For me, however, I came across it, was 13 at my local library. I had already at that point, a lot of emotional realities hit that made it very interesting to me, because someone very dear to me had attempted. They did not successfully attempt, but they had attempted. And so me as a 13-year-old, you know, as I thought of myself then, like, girl, just being like, what does that mean? Like, what do I think about that? And it was also kind of close to the time when Britney Spears had lost her mind very publicly. Like, there was a lot of not just my own life, but also in the world, conversations around mental health in women, right? And so I picked up this book at the library and was like, I had no clue what it was. I didn't know it was something that, like, later I would actually have to read in school. I just was like, wow, this seems hard. Like, this seems cool. And it's short, you know, it's a very short book. Yeah. So for a 13-year-old, I was like, well, hell yeah, I'm just going to rent this one out, not thinking about the impact it would have on my little psyche. But I did. And it really changed my life in a way, because The Awakening, but however, I have two different realities for each read. Because first read, I was so young that I think for me, it was really just finding out other people had felt such depths of despair. And also, even more so, even though I don't know if Kate Chopin herself would have called herself a feminist, I think for what it was such an excellent, like almost like encapsulation of a mood and essence I'd seen in women around me. Just the unhappiness with life, the boring domestic melee, the things that make women, you know, do a lot of crazy shit, really. Like, let's be honest, because life, especially at the time it was written, was very limited. But even more so, it's still, even when I was raised as a 13-year-old, felt limited from my view. In Oklahoma, where I was growing up, which is a very traditional conservative culture. And, you know, so there were a lot of women in my eyes who were having their own awakening stories around me. So I think reading it as a very young person was crazy, because to me, I was just like, this is still real. Like, this is all really real still. And I think it wasn't, I think it was in 10th grade, I had a teacher assign it for the actual class. And then that was annoying, because some people got it, some people didn't. Yeah. But for me, always, like, certain images from The Awakening just stayed with me. Like, whenever I'm near an ocean, throughout my whole life, I'm near an ocean standing there too long, I just think this is just like The Awakening. If I And I'm standing near an ocean even more so, I'm just like, word, like, I get this. So that's like my original interaction with the book, was definitely a very vulnerable in retrospect age, right? But not through how most people have come across The Awakening and understand through like a teacher. It was very much like my own finding. Yeah.
That's incredible. The Awakening is from 1899 by Kate Chopin, who was based in Louisiana, but born in...
I think it's Missouri.
Everyone is very, very French in this story, but I do just have to say her maiden name is something like O'Leary.
So she's an Irish-French, like, mixture. Mm-hmm. I think she married into a Creole family. It was also true. So it's like, I don't know, a lot to analyze, even in Kate Chopin's own mind once you read this, obviously. She was married to this man, but then he ended up like dying, leaving her like $1 million in debt in the modern era. Like that's how much money it had been. And that's why she became a writer, which is even crazier. Mm-hmm. Would not have become a writer if she didn't need money.
She's married at 20 and then he dies, and leaving her $1 million in debt, like you said, she takes over his business for like a year or two. And someone wrote something like, she's an outrageous flirt after her husband dies. She's going wild. But then her mom also dies. The business fails. She sells it. She's super in debt and depressed. And a family doctor, I think, says you should try writing as a therapeutic exercise. So she writes for like 10 years or so. And this comes out in 1899. She dies 5 years later and is never a success during her life. I think this is rediscovered because when it comes out, it's a book about a woman awakening to the fact that her life is unfulfilling and that she wants more. It's really as simple as I want more, which there's a, the first time I sort of realized that, there's an amazing film called Novitiate with Margaret Qualley. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's like the final line in that movie is I want more. Mm-hmm. And that sort of rocked my world and changed my life.
What a great line. Such a good movie. I mean, it's so true. And I mean, fair. And I think, and I do think that's why The Awakening, despite originally, what, was out of print for like decades. It wasn't until the 70s, right?
Yeah.
It came back around. It makes sense to me that her work around that period really, you know, re-spoke to people and be like, whoa, wait, this is still very relevant. This is it. And like, hasn't really went away since for a reason, right? Yeah. But because I think, in my opinion, she was writing for an era she was not a part of. Like she was observing the era, but her work couldn't have been appreciated at all by the people in the day, which is also just fucking crazy when you look at what this, like you read it and it's so well written. Like her word economy, her choice of description, and for what she was doing at her time, she was progressive about like basically like everything. By her standard time. And so there is just like a lot, I don't know, I couldn't help in this reread feel almost frustrated that she never wrote another novel after The Awakening. Yeah. And that she like thought she must be a bad writer then, when in reality it's like, no, you're like a really good writer. You were just like too good for your time.
Exactly.
That's kind of how it feels, you know? And it's so nuts.
Yeah. There's a moment really early on, I think it's the beginning of or six or something, where I was like, oh, we've arrived, like in the book, we've gotten there. And it's a little bit of a long paragraph, but I want to read it. In short, Mrs. Pontellier, who's our protagonist, was beginning to realize her position in the universe as a human being and to recognize her relations as an individual to the world within and about her. This may seem like a ponderous weight of wisdom to descend upon the soul of a young woman of 28, perhaps more wisdom than the Holy Ghost is usually pleased to vouchsafe to any woman.
It bangs so hard, right? Like that, because it's so true. And again, that's another reason, even it's so great that you read that paragraph specifically, because that's another reason this read has hit so much, I think, heavier for me, is I'm 29 now. And so by the end of the book, she's 29. In the beginning, she's 28, and which she does so like elegantly. You don't even realize time's away. But it really hits a lot differently the older you are. And this is kind of what I was left feeling. It's like, wow, it's so wild. We have really young people often assigned to read this book at a time they cannot grasp the realities, usually, right? The full extent of the reality she's discussing, whether it be the curse of domesticity or the lack of fulfillment in the lives of women via the expectations put on them by society and those around them. Another thing that was so more notable in this read for me, which again, exciting is your first reason to dwell, because maybe this was all instant to you while when I was younger, I didn't pick up. It's so much more sapphic, her relationship between her feminine friends, as well as her clear, the cuckoldry of her husband is so pleasurable to me in this read. Like, yeah. I, as a reader, like, yeah, fuck you, Leonce. Like, yeah, she should have Robert and this other guy and maybe a few others. Why not? You know, she's gonna move into the pigeon house. Fuck you. You know, I, it's like, I guess as I've gotten older, not only do I understand Edna more, which is her first name, not just Mrs. Pontellier, it's a, which again, she only mentions Edna a few times, which again, mm-hmm. I think is purposeful because women are not usually seen as associated with themselves. That's nope, you're now Mrs. Pontellier, you know, you're, that's who you are. But I really felt so in her in regards to her anger at her husband in moments and her like frustrations with his idiocy and lack of understanding or refusal to see her in a way that I think I couldn't have grasped when I was younger, because now I've had real adult relationships and like life has happened and I'm like, yeah, fuck you, Leon. It's like, you know what I mean? But I mean, he's not a bad husband. He's not a bad husband. He's just a man of his time. And that's kind of the oddity of him, I think, as a character compared to her. It's like, he's so about the surface, so about what needs to happen, always not really seeing what actually is happening all the while.
Yeah, he's so concerned with perception. Mm-hmm. And every decision is filtered through that. The book takes place over about a year. She has a sort of an unrequited summer fling with this guy, Robert. And then they come back to New Orleans. He goes on a business trip and she decides, I'm going to buy this little house on the corner and have my own house, do my own thing, pare down life, and probably have an affair, or at least think about it. And do I want that? And so I was so, I know that this is taught in schools, which is bizonkers to me, because this is like, not only is this, I understand it as a great feminist text.
It's so immoral in a sense. And it's also a great example of the Southern text too, just in general, like even outside of it being a feminist text, it's like a very full expression of what the South was like at the time it was written.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, one reason why it's still taught, admittedly, because it's easier to read than Gone with the Wind. It's shorter, it more or less shows, hey, yeah, there was some oddity. You know what I mean? But like, there's elements of it, right? Where it's like, I think it's simultaneously because it's a feminist text that it's been revisited in this way, but also because there aren't enough really fantastic women Southern writers that like people have really just allowed to be canon in the same way, which is unfortunate. But I also think it depends on where you are. Because for example, I have a friend who grew up in Washington, never had to read this book in school. And so that's why I do think it might have to do also with it being a text of like a very specific region too.
For sure. Yeah. Which is so fascinating. Absolutely.
Where did you grow up again?
I grew up outside DC in Maryland.
Oh, interesting. Interesting.
Yeah.
But you were not assigned this in school. Was it ever like brought up in school or anything?
I don't think so. I think part of the thing that really confuses me on teaching it in schools, not to get very pearl clutching, but a lot of it is about sex. It's not explicit. It's not, you know, fiery loins, but it is a sexual awakening in addition to a personal awakening of yourself within society. And it is, I think that was one thing that I understand about it, but I kind of wish we had gotten a little bit more sex, gotten a little racier to see her wilding out a little bit more. But I think that's, you know, it's a predecessor. We're there now.
No, exactly. Exactly. But for her time, she's 100% being wild, like on every level, all the time. And so you just kind of are like, whoa, Edna, didn't know you rolled like that. Okay, I guess you do. And to your point, it is interesting because I think, yes, there's a lot of sexuality in it, but I guess having the two reads to compare, right? When I did read So Young, because I did not know the full, obviously, spectrum of human sexuality, the age that I was reading it at, there's a lot that went way over my head. And then the key thing is these universal themes of like the essence of depression, the, you know, the domestic melee, all those things were still there. But that's what I guess I've appreciated so much on this read is the sex is so stunningly present, both in the fantasy of sexuality, the desire for sexuality more so than the action, which is so of the time. And also other things that stood out to me were obviously the maternal elements of postpartum. Like it's surprise to me that like the majority of her kind of breakdown that leads to the end, right? She has the kids with the grandma. And there's only one moment where she's like, I thought about them today. Feel kind of sad. And it's like, she doesn't want to have to shift with the reality that she's now a mother. And to be a mother, especially in the society she was in, but let's be real, all societies all the time, like it's not like this has changed. You have this expectation to give up so much of yourself. And that's so much of what the book is really going off about. Yeah. And I guess that's another reason for me it hits a little differently is I, having had a body now on this planet for 29 years, I've had experiences that I've dealt with some of those hormones. And let me tell you, like, we do not talk enough about how women need therapeutic support when they have children, how easy it is to develop postpartum depression, either when you have had the kid, and especially in the cases where you don't, such as in the case of miscarriage, abortion, because you will get postpartum from that too. No one wants to talk about that, but all of the above is true. And it doesn't matter which route it goes. It's like, you need care. And so reading this, it was also so difficult at moments to be like, God, she's clearly like really struggling with this. The ability to see herself as a nurturing, caring being in the way, for example, Madame Ratignol is, which she so admires. Mm-hmm. And it really struck me that right before the end, her going over to Madame Ratignol's birth and saying, I remember it and I remember feeling nothing. And I just was like, oh God.
Yeah. And there's even a line, something that's like, why does nature do this to women? Or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. At the back of my book, the very it says is the mother woman, their dash woman, which is in one of the earliest chapters. They were women who idolized their children, worshipped their husband, and esteemed it a whole privilege to efface themselves as individuals and grow wings, stirring angels.
Yes.
Stunning for 1899.
And it's so true. Like, it's so true. Yeah. There are still women that are like this, and there's still, and, you know, and even more so at that time, I can imagine, but at the same time, it's like these archetypes that we're held to be, right? And the moment you become a mother, in the same way, the moment you become a wife, regardless of your own choice in the matter, you're an extension of something.
Exactly. You don't exist on your own.
Yeah. You don't. Not in a legal sense, not in a financial sense. And, you know, what's interesting about reading this work, I think it did lead me to a fixation with quote unquote bad women in my life, both my own badness, but also the badness of others. Or like, and by that, I quite literally just mean the ability to go against the grain of what is expected for your whole existence. Because technically, you know, coming out of the Bible Belt as I do, I mean, I was raised in a society where people thought that like, and I was told all the time, like, well, hopefully you get a good husband. Hopefully you do this. Yeah, even if you say you don't want to get married and have kids, well, just wait.
Give
it time. And by that, they mean wait till you're 22 and you start popping them out because that's what's normal there. And that's also still what's normal, obviously, in the awakening. The fact she's like two kids and she's, or, you know, like when she's like fucking 28, 29. I mean, that was what's normal. She would have been seen as an old hag if she hadn't done
that. Yeah, absolutely. Literally. And there's this amazing, I would give up the unessential. I would give my money, I would give my life for my children, but I wouldn't give myself.
Banger, yes.
Yeah, and there's like an echo of that later on, but yeah.
No, because she brings it up before she's walking into the sea, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, she describes. She
literally says, this is what I was meaning as she's killing herself, quite literally, which is so powerful. Yeah. Again, this is what I mean by word economy and choice of just like the repetition of certain statements in certain moments. I mean, she's so masterful with the way she writes it.
She describes her children as antagonists. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, devils, basically. Like little devils.
Yeah.
Didn't she basically call them like the prison guards of her soul or something?
They had overpowered and sought to drag her into the soul's slavery for the rest of her days.
Which, to be fair, when I read this at 14, 13, whatever it was, I was like, yes. That does seem like being a mother is to me. And, you know, admittedly, it's not that I think it has to be that way, but I think just the nature of expectation and the reality of repetition generations, it almost always still turns out that way. You know, I only think in more recent generations have we truly even come to understand the balancing act of what it means to be a person and to be something else such as that too.
Yeah.
So that's why this is such like a fantastic work that I do think it's amazing that it is taught to young people, despite obviously the fact that it's sexual and all these things, because mm-hmm. for a certain type of person, especially where I guess it seems to be taught,
yeah.
you don't see any examples of people breaking the rules like that. You really don't.
Absolutely.
And so, to me, I was like, this is fucking incredible. It just blew my mind because it just made me not only think about what was possible in one's life, but also what seems to be inevitable and what I don't want, what I do want. It forces those questions forward at a pretty young age when you do read The Awakening so young, because there's nobody that's going to tell you, oh yeah, sometimes marriage can be like this and sometimes having yeah. kids is like this, because everyone has to tell you, especially if you're the kid, everything's great. However,
exactly.
adult life's not really like that. And I think Kate Chopin was pretty fucking brave writing this, admittedly.
Yeah, without a doubt. How did your class kind of, you said some people obviously didn't get it. How is that sort of received as well as taught in high school?
Well, I feel like what it was taught about for my, I believe it was my 10th grade class when we visited officially, and I'd already read it. So for me, I was like, oh, great. Like, it's so easy. Like, you know, I was just like, yeah, I've already done this. Great. But what I found, therefore, more interesting was seeing other people's reactions to it. And
right.
I don't know, some people really got it. But I do think due to where I was in the country, I grew up right outside of Tulsa, public education system. You know, it still can be very, this narrative is very counterintuitive to what you're being sold, quite literally. And what you
want to
believe about life and your hope of what things can be, right? And so the way it was taught was pretty like on the nose about like how it was dealing with like mental health and depression, but that it's a great example of, again, like early Southern society and complexities, obviously on race. Cause obviously there's a lot she does regarding race in the book, like just mm-hmm. so much that would like white writers of her time would have just like not acknowledged like a lot that she chooses to do. And,
yeah.
but in a way that for her time would have been incredibly progressive. And so I think it was like often used as a stepping stone to other conversations really. Plus, you know, since it would have been around like Hurricane Katrina. Like there was a lot.
Right.
So we also have like within recent history. Yeah. So there was a lot that New Orleans was just in the conversation. Right. But even more so though, in regards to the student reaction, I think for some people, it just was really dark. And also obviously there were some boys, there will always be boys
yeah.
in a 10th grade English class. They'll be like, well, I don't really get why we need to read this. I think this is, you know, da-da-da-da. You know what I mean? So it was one of those things where the people that understood it, I think understood it so wholly that it was almost disturbing. So they didn't want to talk about it.
Right.
And just made a laugh out of it. Because they didn't have the emotional maturity to carry the story yet, you know?
Yeah.
Which is why I posted the other day being like, if you have not reread yeah. this, reread it, because reading as an adult is just so fucking different. There's also so many parallels that I miss in the first one, like with the actual like kind of womanizing Arabin that she meets, who's this, mm-hmm. you know, figure. I kind of always forget about him, but then I was like, oh yeah, this guy. And then I was thinking more of, oh, he's supposed to be someone who would actually, you know, break her boundaries of her marriage, kiss her, mm-hmm. versus Robert, who's like actually to stand up, wouldn't actually do that, but is clearly deeply in love with her. You know, and Robert, I feel as a character is totally like, it's funny because the term manic pixie dream girl didn't even exist yet, obviously, but he's like a manic pixie dream man. Like he's 100%. This perfect, loving guy who wants to talk to her, wants to spend time with her. Adores her, actually sees her as a full person. There's nothing unique or interesting about Robert. They actually make a very
not in the slightest.
No, she makes a big point of being like, this is kind of just his thing. Like he loves married women, but always in this very specific, you know, way. And yet she's just so like, wow, I'm being seen. And I really feel like if anything, Robert is this fascinating, almost like thermometer for how lonely she truly is in her marriage. How unseen she truly is,
yeah.
uncared for, because she, like, it's just very sad. And then Arabin even more so, because he's an actual, like, everybody's like, you're going to ruin your reputation even hanging out with him. Like,
yeah.
that's said multiple times that she's like, I don't care. And even yeah. Robert, hears about it. But her husband's just like, whatever. Oh, I also did not pick up when I was young on the fact that it's so evident that her husband's just going to see workers like all the time. Like when he's going to like the club, like he's going to the club, you know?
Right. Yeah. I hadn't picked up on that either. I did sort of read it as like, no, he's going to the casino.
Like, do I have like 10? I interpreted this time quite differently, but that's just my life. I was just like, there's no way he's being faithful to her. Like that's society.
Absolutely. Yeah. I do want to talk about, what do you sort of make of the water imagery that prefaces the beginning and the end? She walks into the sea, very Virginia Woolf. She sheds all of her clothing and is like, this is the first time I'm naked in the light of the sun, which is so beautiful.
No, it's so gorgeous, right? Well, first of all, I guess just the ending, I cry like a lot.
Yeah.
Let me get to the end because it is just so beautiful and heartbreaking and so beautifully written, obviously. But the imagery itself, I feel like, was supposed to, like, the ocean, in my opinion, this is just me, right? Like, is supposed to be symbolic modern life and being an adult and like being encompassed by things that you actually cannot control at all and that can only drown you, quite literally. And then I feel like the symbolic choice of, like, the literal and symbolic choice of walking in the ocean is giving in to the reality that she has no control and all this floundering she's been doing this whole novel to get any stake of like, well, I'm going to start painting again. I'm going to have a pigeon house. She realizes all of this is for naught because it doesn't change the reality of her life. Even if she were to do everything she's doing, it doesn't change anything. Yeah. She can't be the person she loves. She can't actually have a successful art career. She's always going to be seen as Mrs. Pontellier and a mother. And yeah, I mean, I think therefore the water is meant to be this space where she actually gives in to the fact nothing can matter in her life. Yeah. Like she has no control of it to allow it to matter.
Yeah, it's sort of the only choice that she can enact on her own and be in control is to die. That's the only way she can belong to herself.
And, also, and this was something I realized the second watch. Because I really didn't pay attention to it on the first read. It's just, she learned how to swim throughout the beginning of the book.
Yeah.
She learns how to swim enough to swim out to die.
Do I remember it correctly that Robert teaches her how to swim?
Yeah, I think he's involved with it. And then she ends up, you know, taking what he teaches her to do her own. And yeah, I mean, it's like she gets her legs only enough to realize she can't go that far with them, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, it may be in a way that makes more sense with the modern imagery that became more popular post-LOL The Awakening. But, well, no, straight up, because I really feel like The Awakening sets, like, there's so much symbolism that references The Awakening and everything. Even White Lotus, this last season, there was this dream that Parker Posey's character has where she's right in front of the ocean and you just say you see the waves carrying. And I remember thinking, holy shit, they're doing The Awakening. Like, is she going to kill herself at some point? Is this what they're hinting at? Like, because, like, everything can be The Awakening once you've seen how it goes. You know? And it's everywhere. And so the symbolism also, like, the ocean being this element of just what it feels like to be that depressed and that stuck, right, too. But that also, I honestly feel like she was a part of that symbolism and expression being seen as that. So it's hard. Like, I don't think she was just doing her thing. And now everyone's like, you're right. That's true.
Yeah.
It is being in a ocean where I'm going to drown. Exactly. Like, everyone loves the term, like, oh, how does it feel to be depressed? Oh, I can't keep my head above water. It's like, yeah, it's The Awakening. Everything's The Awakening. And it's so
it's everywhere.
No, it is. But I'm a bit awakening pilled right now with my reread because it is hard not to see it everywhere to some extent once you refamiliarize yourself with it, because there aren't as many works that I feel have so accurately and aptly talked about so much of it with such grace.
Yeah. I read this just coming off of a previous episode reading Great Gatsby. And so both of those are so short. And there is such an incredible economy of every single line has a purpose. Like, the very first line in this book is, a green and yellow parrot, which hung in a cage outside the door, kept on repeating over and over again, get out, damn it. That's all right. She's the parrot.
No, literally.
She's in the golden cage.
And that's the thing is, like, it really is one of those things that every single word is purposeful. there's no word that she just kind of like lackadaisically, like she was so excellent at her craft in a way that, again, another reason I tell everyone to reread it, because I'm like, yeah, you're just going to forget how good of a fucking writer she was, because yeah. She really was. I'd forgotten one really great scene in this reread, that like the one where she's out in the hammock and her husband comes and he basically waits all night with her just because she's busy throwing a fit. And yeah. I remember, amazing. Like, I was just reading, be like, oh, word, yeah, this is great. Like, this is insane behavior. I love this. I just think there's something about the resentments she feels towards him yeah. that are so palpable in the read. That she herself won't actually just directly state. So she'll say like all the, yeah, he's all right, husband. Yeah. But then she's like, yeah, he's been away for months, whatever. I enjoy not having to breathe near him. And you're like,
yeah. Okay. Yeah. Like, all right. The emotions are so visceral. Absolutely. It's yeah. It's a whole body. All of the other women have the French madame or mademoiselle in front of yeah. their words, and she's always misses. She's an outsider. Yeah.
True.
Every
little detail. Oh, and I love the bit with her colonel father when he comes to visit. Yes. I just thought that was so interesting. The whole filial attitude she has towards him, where she's just, I have to take care of every little bit and all this. When she's definitely not like that with her husband or her children or anyone else, the whole book.
Yeah.
Even with the men she's into, they cater to her, not the other way around. It really is only her father, which I found interesting.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't really interrogate that. That's fascinating. Yeah.
It's like all of the men all cater to her. Her children put up with her negligence of them and caring about them, unfortunately. Very sad, actually. Yeah. I do feel bad for them on this read a bit more than I did when I was a child, which is ironic, right. Maybe. But at the same time, it's like, yeah, her father is the only one that she truly is willing to like serve hand and foot over heels. And I found that really interesting, for sure. It makes you wish you'd had some sort of other story just about her childhood with her dad or something. Because you're almost like, how did you end up this way? What was your dad really like? Because it's a different person,
how she is,
than with anyone else.
Which and I there's find, even the, her sister is getting married and she won't go to the wedding.
She won't
go. And she's being very childish, which is very nice. Like, it's nice to see her.
Progression.
Yes, which is fun. And it's like, it's nice to grow up and then be an adult and be like, no, I'm going to have a tantrum because I didn't have enough actually when I was young, because I was so busy making myself smaller for other people and catering to other people's needs.
Really,
it's incredible.
Though,
yeah.
Which actually, we might have just answered a thing about the dad, because it did occur to me, again, this is written at the time it is, and we look at Kate Chopin's life, her whole family, I mean, what's wild, her family side with the Confederate. They got kicked out of St. Louis for doing so. She didn't return for decades. But thinking about the fact that she makes the point of being like, oh, my father is like this Confederate, you know, colonel. He's this military man. I guess we kind of might maybe just answer the question, which is, oh, it's very possible that Edna's childhood was during the Civil War or like her teenhood. And then maybe there was a lot that might have been put to the side because war was ongoing. Her father was, you know, I don't know. But that's very possible, actually, now I think about it, because there's so much. You don't end up like her out of nowhere. There's a lot more than just the domestic melee, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And being a Confederate colonel, he lost.
They quite literally lost the war. And that's just the facts of it. And I'm sure for a person of Edna's time, that was probably a point of constant conversation on both sides. I mean, just the subject of the war, right? Like, it was, I have to imagine the whole generation of people, both in the North and South, their whole lives were fundamentally, you know, shifted and formed around it as an event that happened. And when you remember that this story is technically like a post-Civil War narrative, and you're like, oh, well, no wonder this woman's kind of insane. Like, literally, like, and pretty depressed and doesn't really know what to do with herself, because, I mean, like, no one probably did, I would imagine. Not that I have empathy from that point of view. I mean, that's just what it is. But it is more just like, damn, okay, well, that explains why she's so fixated on her dad being in a different way, because, God, interaction with a, you know, a colonel that, like, has lost his war sounds, like, hellish a bit. Yeah. Like, it actually sounds like, I had two Marine parents, and just wow. like having the idea of having to hear that, like, well, if we just won that one battle like a billion times, you know,
right.
probably not fun for you, Brian.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Man, having two Marine parents, there's got to be a lot of stories there and a lot.
Oh, for sure. I didn't analyze it too much, but I became like an antithesis of a Marine in my own self. But fundamentally, yeah, no, I wouldn't exist if they had not met on a base. So kind of crazy. My mom totally outranked my dad, which is the more funny thing about it, ironically. So, you know, obviously to me, really awakening, that's another thing that probably informed my view of the story is, again, I was raised by like a mother who like did not actually have a grasp on femininity in the way that most women do. I've been in the U.S. Marine Corps for nearly 20 years. I think she, bad choice on her part, but she did not stay for the retirement year because she started having children. Bad choice economically. However, due to that, she was a very tough and is a very tough woman. And so just the conceptual aspect of this world, right, where like in the awakening, you're supposed to be this soft, maternal, nurturing mother. I was like, what are those? You know, I was like, what are those? I don't know those. Someone like Edna, you know, made a lot more sense, like being a woman or person in general who almost ended up as a parent and ended up in the circumstances of life where you're like, well, that's not for me. Fuck, well, I'm in it now.
Yeah. Near the end, the doctor, who is a really interesting character.
I like him too. Said, yes.
He says basically like nature tricks you into becoming a mother. It seems to be a provision of nature, a decoy to secure mothers for the race. And nature takes no account of moral consequences of arbitrary conditions we create and which we feel obligated to maintain at any cost.
Yeah. Amazing. And then also the line says to her, he's basically like, I feel like if we talked, I, you know, you'd be able to understand me and I'd be able to understand you. It makes you wonder, he talk about his own experiences of depression or maybe his own troubles of the choice becoming a father or like any of the above, we will never know. Another thing I found interesting is I do think he must have been suspecting her of postpartum depression because he gets so mad at Madame Retignol for having her for the birth. Remember, he like kind of eats her out or whatever, where he's just like, hey, like, you can't do that. That's not going to be good for her. Why didn't you call like any other person? And Madame Retignol doesn't really understand why that would be a wrong thing to do. And it's interesting because that's like one of the only lines from somebody that truly is being like, even hinting at postpartum.
The
fact that she's like, oh, it'd be good for her to see a birth is implying he knows that she's having some mental things around her own feelings about being a mother, you know, in a real way. And it is sad. I would have been curious to know just objectively like what he said.
He's a really interesting character, and he, even before Aerobin starts flirting with her, he is like, oh god, I hope it's not him. There's such a perspective of him think he has seen this pattern before and he like knows the steps of it.
No, exactly. Right before she becomes fixated on Aerobin. It's funny because she isn't even involved with Aerobin at the point he says that. He's just like, well, he's vulnerable. I guess I know who might be showing up soon, which is really saying a lot about Aerobin's character, right? Like, he's a womanizer who maybe purposely goes after the most vulnerable women who are feeling weird about their husbands or their children. You know what I mean? Like, it's so gross. But also, it is just like, really fucking sad. Where you're just like, like you're abandoning your children. And that was something that was like really difficult on this read. On one level, I totally get why it was written. I get why it was expressed. And what's funny again is I think Kate Tropen ended up having six children. She had six children. She did not like not have kids. And yet she just wrote a narrative where it's like, how do I just kill myself instead of having to deal with y'all? And it's just like,
you really hope they never read it.
Like, I don't know if any of her, I'm assuming some of her kids must have read some. I don't know though. If your mom wrote that, would you want to read it? Question, right? I don't know if I want to read my mom's version of that. I'm like, I'm sure
that would break me.
I know. I'm a bit like, but at the same time, doesn't mean it's a lesser work. It's still very, very good. Yeah. It just more, I think she was able to encapsulate so much of like what later became so evident, which is women are not happy. It's like she did what The Feminine Mystique by Betty Friedan
exactly.
did without having to have a stat involved. Even though, again, another really well-written narrative. Like, that nonfiction work is actually so well-written. It's insane. You forget how well-written it is. But it's really well-written. However, encapsulated in just, like, such a short time, the exact mood and issue is in The Awakening.
Yeah, like, women, like 50, 60 years ahead of time. Yeah.
Yes. And obviously, what's even more frustrating maybe about the fact of what we just said is between the time Kate Chopin wrote this and Betty Friedan wrote The Feminine Mystique, the status for women shifted so much farther back by the 50s and the 40s. Like, it's so sad and frustrating. It makes me think about all this stuff with the SAVE Act recently, with the whole basically, you know, oh, you have to bring a birth certificate. Well, what about married women who don't use it? Did you just take away the right to vote for a bunch of married women? Is that what just happened? Yeah. And it goes back to what we were saying of, like, the moment a woman chooses to get married, they become an extension of someone else. Yeah. Here's the thing. I love love. I love love. I'm a bitch for love. I love falling in love. I love the idea of a partnership. I love the idea of having someone who has your back. You know, I love my partner, you know. But let me tell you, I think the concept of marriage in itself, and maybe this is also because I read too much Emma Goldman at a young age, but that's obviously was not in the but trust me. You know, like, marriage in itself is such a contract. It's such a legal transactional agreement, which another thing that's great about The Awakening is it's so evidently seen in that, you know, the way it's all approached. So, and we now in the modern lens want to act like that's not what it is, because we've been sold the idea of free love and marrying into free love. You know what I mean? And by free love, I don't mean, like, I just mean marrying for love, not free love in the 60s sense, but just more this escalation of what marriage is in the modern era, right? But in reality, it doesn't change the fact that all of the other things are still true. And the fact that the moment, unfortunately, and this is all very gender binary, of course, and that doesn't necessarily, you know, there's a lot to go into that. But at the same time, if you're taking the traditional gender binary of, like, a woman and a man in a traditional marriage, quote unquote, like straight marriage, right? Cishet straight marriage. It is inevitably always going to be a thing where the woman is seen as lesser on a level when dealing with certain institutional and legal and all of the above. Therefore, The Awakening had a huge impact on me. Both on my views of marriage, like, really the combo hit of Kate and Emma just being like, don't do it. But also just, like, just the truth of how married women are seen in society, how they're treated, how they're expected to be. It's quite toxic and almost counterintuitive to the truth of just, like, your own human identity and wholeness, right? And I think that is why The Awakening is still to this day such a powerful work, is it gets to the truth of that instead of ignoring it or putting it in some nuance or something. It's like, nope, this is just what this is.
Yeah. It's so straightforward when it gets to and it's not soapboxy, but she does say, like, let me lay it out very clearly. And I think it's interesting when approaching this as a young person, there are so many themes and discussions of belonging to yourself. And of course, that is through the lens of being a wife, being a mother, but also I think that's very true for any child where you are inherently someone else's. You're treated kind of like property. Yeah.
And that's still true to this day. I mean, the way people interact with their children is if their children have no individual rights because it's still their child, which is crazy as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I am a huge believer, in the rights of all people, but specifically the rights of women, the rights of children, the rights of just, like, basically anybody who is typically not seen as being able to make their own decisions historically, and how unfactual that is. Like, it's just not true. And obviously, like, we all, there are certain things, like, a kid can't do. Like, a kid can't file their own taxes, but there's no need, right? Because they don't make money like that. Doesn't matter. You know, that's fine. But, like, also, a kid can have an opinion on what's moral, what's just, what's, and the big questions of human life. Like, what is death? What does it mean to be born? Is there a God? And what's insane is if you read, like, really old texts of, like, old-timey misogynists in, like, 1700s, 1800s, like, you know, they'll be like, do women even think about those? They'll talk about women as if they're children. The same way people talk about children now. It's, like, paralleled bird economy of all the descriptions. And you're just sitting there like, what the fuck, you know? Like,
you have to be reminded of the fact that we as a human culture are still so far behind where we should be, I think, in regards to how we approach other people that are other than ourselves. And the unfortunate fact of the matter is we live in, well, one, very fascistic times. That's just factual, right? Where there's like a very clear, like, you know, this is who's in charge, this is what's right, this is this, this is this. When in reality, no, everybody has their own approach to life and own experiences that form them. And all of those can be quite interesting and valid. And there is no just like cutting out of one. And the issue is when you look at the way that society's traditionally interacted with women, the subject of women, whether it be how it used to be, where it's just very blunt, or how it is now, where it's just like, oh yeah, you know, I like women lit, but I don't want to read books by women though, you know, like. People still carry the same things. Or I also, and this is just really random, but, you know, for example, like the confessional tone in poetry is associated with women really heavily, right? And writers that are not men, to put it simply. And the amount of times where I'll just randomly run into discourse with people like, well, that's not serious work. And I'm like, oh, is it not serious because you associate with women though? Because I've read your work and it's not that good. So how can you say that's not that serious? I've definitely wanted to say that to somebody before, but I've held my tongue. I'm not a jerk, but I thought it, you know, and I do think that there's still to this day so much blatant sexism that comes out that we are now, because it's been discourse to death, don't want to talk about it anymore. We're all tired of pointing out how ridiculous someone is, which is real. And that's why it's refreshing with The Awakening, because it was still so early in so many of the things she's discussing and writing about. And in a way, it feels even more pertinent because of everything going on.
For sure. Yeah, there's... I did a little bit of looking into Bimbo Land, and there was one specific selection that I was like, oh, this is, it's one-to-one, this is The Awakening. So if you'll allow me to quote you a little bit. I wanted to be away for so long, I only knew how to be away, and then there was no way to go back. No one ever tells you that back is non-existent. There is only the cold, devastating future.
Oh yeah, that's very Awakening influenced. No, I mean, 100% spot on. I think a part of why this read really hit me is the older I've gotten, the more I've become as a person, but also as a writer, I understand Kate Chopin's choice to write this so much more too. And some of the themes that I often find in my own work, sex and death, LOL, very huge part of it, often do have to do with just like how devastating daily existence can be. Not that it has to be, but how it can be, and how much time can be like this really heavy weight that hits you when you least expect it, yet in a way that you should have always been expecting it almost. And there's something about that in Kate's writing as well, where it's like everything she writes feels so inevitable and devastating at the same time. And I think, yeah, like I definitely feel with Bimbo Land, which is just poems about sex, admittedly, which I, you know, fun. But also, I mean, it's more about like the process of having a sex addiction and when sex has become something that like rules you, like desire, and when desire becomes your own master as a way of thinking, right? Like you are kind of ruled by what that needs in the way any kind of addiction can be, which going back to a part of our earlier conversation, this book is so sexual because I do think that also had a huge impact on me, that and watching Nymphomania by Lars von Trier in high school too many times. Okay. I mean, there's a lot of things that when I look back, this is why it wasn't appropriate to do, but I did, and here I am. So, you know, I don't know. I became who I am, but I do think a lot of Bimbo Land deals with similar themes of The Awakening, actually, and the fact that for me, I'd come to this understanding of an aspect of womanhood that was at least defining for me when I would view myself as a woman or not, right, was the feeling of being a sexualized being against my will, and how the only way to have control over that was to take all of my sex into my own hands and become the most agented sexual being in the world, which was not healthy. However, it made so much sense at that time. In the same way for Kate Chopin's character in The Awakening, like her own agency was that choice to kill herself. So much of self-sabotage or devastatingly destructive behavior is a choice of agency when you feel out of control. which I think
that's self-harm. Yeah.
Which is, again, I think a huge theme of Bimbaland for sure in a way. But I'm proud of the work. So thank you for reading it. Thank you for looking at it. That's very nice of you.
Of course.
I was so mad. I was like, oh, my book. I was like, I came for you. Like, but I mean, it is funny because I mean, I do think Kate Chopin just influenced who I became as a writer. So it's not surprising you can read something in there and be like, oh, yeah, I can see that. Like, yes.
Oh, man, that's some of my favorite parts of the podcast is finding the influences and how it shapes people as authors and as artists. You mentioned some queer aspects in it. Do you want to expound on that?
Well, for me, specifically with Madame Ratignol, and even with Madame Reese a little, like, there's just these fixations in other women that are really more encompassing than, again, her feelings about her husband. They're more complicated, they're more mature, they're more the people she really talks to, right?
Yeah.
And there's something with Madame Ratignol specifically, and maybe a part of it, it is the way we're really introduced to her as a character is in relation to Robert and being the person Robert was fixated on before. So it could have also been like her picking up Robert's attraction to Madame Ratignol and owning it herself. That's the thing that people do all the time. Like, maybe that's it.
For sure.
But the way Madame Ratignol is described, she's so beautiful. She's so graceful, all the things that, you know, Edna doesn't see in herself, such as the maternal and nurturing nature, all very attracted to her. All these things, you know, that I think feel very much, I don't know, I feel like a different period of time, there would have been more explored between their relationship, right? That's what I think. I just interpreted it as a lot more sapphic than I recalled. I guess.
Yeah, she sets up these incredible, because there are only maybe six major characters in this novel, but everyone is such perfect parallels, like Mademoiselle Reese and Madame Ratignol and Robert and Arodin. But they're they are really great complements of each other, and
her father, one who's actually very strict with her. Leonce, you need to teach her a lesson. Why are you hitting my kid or something? Like,
when she's getting the pigeon house, we get a moment from her husband's perspective that's like, she'll tire herself out with this. Like, it's best to just like let it run its course and she'll come around. And that's so patronizing. Yeah.
Oh, so patronizing. No, he just, and I think that's the one thing, even though Leonce is by all means a good enough husband or father, whatever, he's absolutely an incredibly patronizing person who does not believe she's capable of much at all. Yet he's also exactly the type of person that if she were to ever be like, you don't think I'm capable of anything, he'd be like, I don't know what you're talking about. You're my wife. You're capable of anything. I can't believe you would say that about me. When in reality, it's like everything you do screams, you don't think I can do this.
Yeah. She, like, within the first couple pages says that he sees her as an object explicitly.
And that's so accurate.
Yeah.
And the fact he's comfortable with Robert basically being the emotional cuck to their relationship because he's like, well, at least you're dealing with her emotions. I know you want to actually fuck her. So. That's basically.
Exactly. Like, he really is not pressed about Robert. Yeah.
He's not at all. He's, if anything, he's grateful because he's like, thank God, now I don't have to deal with my wife.
Absolutely. And Robert has a pattern of it. He's like, every summer he is a new woman. And there's, I think, a sense of like, when you're setting her up in comparison to Madame Ratignol, she feels a little bit plain Jane. So I think there's an element of like, this summer I'm chosen. And like, when I had my first romance, that's exactly how it felt. And of course that starts an awakening because now you start to see yourself as desirable. There's something within you.
If I'd known I was desirable this whole time, how differently everything could be. I could have acted like this. But even the fact that like the ability to reach agency through desirability, and this is going back to Bimbaland, there's something going on in the aspect of a woman's psyche when they're on the edge, where sexuality is always at this kind of peak, like a hypersexuality, hyper desire, ability to be seen as desired as a part of how one is able to do that. And it's fascinating. And it's also, it reminds me of how in the beginning of the book, when I believe it was Mademoiselle Ratignol was just like, Robert, don't do this. She'll take it seriously. Like, she literally says that to him. And guess she what? Does. She totally
does. That's the whole book. She does.
That's the whole book. Yeah. No, it's crazy. She doesn't hide as a writer. She is like, guess what? This is what you're about to see happen. Like, really early. Even the stuff with the ocean, like, is so evident in the beginning. Like, you know where it's going. the ocean imagery happens every two pages. It's just constant. Almost like this suicidal siren call that is just ever present. Like there's something about it and how it is able to touch on so many really difficult topics, such as suicide, such as the, you know, limitations of women's life, married life, being a parent, having an affair, all of these things in such a short book.
Yes.
That is something I also want to just shout out Kate Chopin. She's dead as hell. She's not going to hear this, but whatever. Kate Chopin did an amazing job of doing all of that in such a short book, which not everyone can do that. That is such a sheer talent and ability to do so. I mean, you and I, I'm sure, both have read books that are like 20 times as long that are all attempting to do the same things and don't even pull it off. So you're just like a master at the page, truly.
Absolutely. Would you consider it required reading?
Yeah. Oh my God. Absolutely. Yeah. I think if someone hasn't, like, I actually found out what friends haven't, because I've just been talking about how I was going to go do this and talk to you about this book. So I'd bring it up and people like, oh, I haven't read that. And I'd be like, you haven't read The Awakening? It's like someone telling me it's the Godfather or something. It just feels like sacrilegious. Not that I hold against people. Everyone can approach culture in their own due time. I'm not like a pretentious jerk like that. However, doesn't mean I don't think people should. I think they should. Like, I do. Yeah. I think people benefit from having to sit with this book and what it brings up in them emotionally, for sure.
Yeah. Hand out copies.
Yeah, no, honestly, that's really should be my next career. So I'm just giving out copies of The Awakening to people. That would be pretty incredible. That would be so silly and funny. Pretty, like, make that my life's mission. Like, it's a Bible. What if, you know, in a very Station 11-esque era thing, like, I give away so many copies of The Awakening when societal collapse comes, there's people that are worshiping Edna, and they all do, like, these drownings for their religious ceremonies. Who knows? The future's
shout
out
to Station 11. Incredible book. Yeah.
The book and incredible adaptation. I think both worked really well, actually. I liked both.
That's all I've got. Is there anything you'd like to plug? Thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, thank you. I guess not this issue of LARB, but the next issue of LARB that should be coming in the summer. I'm going to have a short story called The Party coming out. So look for that. That's awesome. What I'm all about. Yeah, okay. But thank you so much for having me on, though. Thank you. And let me.
All right. I'm going to stop the recording.